Today's show is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending has a hassle-free, year-round fundraising program for schools. You can learn more at schoolspiritvending.com.
Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where school leaders go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top influencers in education. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Daniel Bauer.
In today's show, I connect with a friend and mastermind member, Colin Hogan. He talks about how to give everybody a seat at the table, why Michelle Obama didn't give him a job, the power of running a post office with first graders, and the therapy dog, and how he gets all these innovative ways of operating on a day-to-day basis. Hey, thanks for listening. I never take it for granted, and enjoy the show. Well, hey there, Better Leaders. I am here with a good friend, Colin Hogan, and he is in the mastermind with me, and we've developed a really nice relationship. I love his perspective on education. I think it's refreshing. He's a lot of fun to talk to, so I think that'll come through in the show. No pressure, Colin, but we're going to have a great time today, and listeners, I hope you enjoy it as well. Colin is the head of school at Learning Community Charter School. From 2010 to 2013, he was a social studies coordinator for the Highland Park School District. He taught sixth grade history in Highland Park from 04 to 2010. And prior to coming to Highland Park, Mr. Hogan taught at Princeton Charter School. Mr. Hogan began his career in education in 1999, teaching at the Academy of Communications and Technology at the Bernard Zell Anche Emmett Day School in Chicago, which I should know where it's at, but I don't. Sorry. He has won numerous awards for teaching and was recognized as, listen to this, New Jersey History Teacher of the Year in 2013. Before becoming a teacher, he worked as a community organizer in both Israel and New York City. Colin earned his Bachelor of Arts in History at Indiana University, pursued graduate studies in early adolescent education at Bank Street College of Education, and at the NJ Excel program. Mr. Hogan currently serves as president of the Keene University Diversity Council, the state's premier prejudice reduction and Holocaust education consortium for New Jersey schools. Colin, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. This is a very big honor, and I'm really excited. Just to be clear, you blended my two schools in Chicago. My first teaching job ever was sadly a school that I don't think exists anymore on the West Side, the Academy of Communications and Technology Charter School. And then I moved up to the Bernard Zell Anche Emmett Day School on the North Side. So I switched neighborhoods and economic groups dramatically.
Where was Academy of Communications and Tech?
We were on the West Side on Washington, and the cross street was Kildare. We're sort of located in an old Catholic school. The school was taken over eventually, I believe, by KIPP, but I'm not sure whether it's still around anymore. They had to close. Some of the founders are at the U of C now, I believe.
I think Chicago gave the West Side to Oak Park and let them figure it out.
It was really, really tough work that first year, I gotta say. But really amazing work. Yeah. Some of the things that I think about now as a principal, I learned a lot from that. I think a lot about that in my first year. That's been one of the amazing things. I've done a lot of charter work.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What I love about charters is that, you know, one thing that I will say is it can be a really divisive issue. Recently, I had to go to a hearing at the state, and there were all these people there that were really angry about some new regulations that might happen for charter schools. And it was tough because I think that, you know, I still really do believe the idea of charter schools is that they can be really unique places for experimentation and to really kind of really go out of the box in terms of thinking about relationships between schools, parents, teachers. And I think those are all things in the places that I've been, have been there. I completely understand. For everybody out there that's listening that's really anti-charter, I completely understand why you feel that way. My closest friend and former teaching partner and I completely disagree on this issue. But I do think that there are really exciting things that can come out of this. And I think the opportunity to give everybody more of a seat at the table is important in schools no matter where you are. And that's one of the things I really have liked about working in a charter system is they do afford that.
So I like this idea of giving everybody a seat at the table. How do you currently do that in your role in your school?
You know, that's an interesting point. And that's been something that as that's one of the best things about being the head of school, because I've had a lot of opportunity to really expand that. I am really fortunate because the school that I currently work at is a very progressive one. It was founded by parents that wanted to create an opportunity for all of the children of Jersey City to have the most, you know, dynamic and progressive, and I guess, you know, the kind of education that at that time when the school was founded in the 90s, that was, you could really only find across the river in the best private schools in New York City. And they wanted this for their students. And that school has really been focused on that since then. But what I've been doing over the past 4 years at the school is that I've really tried to bring more people to the table in terms of decision making. One of the groups that I really felt was kind of left out of that, interestingly enough, were our students. They were not part of surveys. So when I got there, that was one thing that I really wanted us to see happen, is collecting more data from students about how we were doing. And we've surveyed them, but one of the things I'm really proud of is that I also had the chance when I was doing I've done a lot of work at the school around math curriculum, interestingly enough, even though my background's in social studies, but I've been very interested in math since I've been there. And we've done a lot of focus groups with that. And I really have found running student focus groups has been very powerful. And I've learned a lot through that. I worked with an amazing math coach, someone that worked with Lucy West and one of our math coaches. And it was amazing. And I learned how to do student focus groups. And now what we also do, one of my favorite things that I get to see done is that I get to see the students every month. We do a school-wide assembly, and our students convey an award. The faculty members give students awards based on our school values, but the students also give an award to a faculty member. Ooh. And the conversations that these students have, they get the nominations that everyone submits, but that's done through a Google form. But then what happens is that the students have a discussion about the faculty members that have been nominated and why they should have it. It is one of the most powerful things. You just to sit in there, it is one of the best things as a school leader to hear our students really have a really respectful, serious debate about this. And what was really cool was, is we had an issue that was incredible. About a month or two back, some of the faculty members said, hey, everybody that's winning this award lately has been in the middle school. That's because the kids that are making these decisions are middle school students. So I brought it to the students and they said, well, what they wanted to do was they wanted to bring fourth and fifth graders into the process. So for the past 2 months, fourth and fifth graders have been coming to our middle school student council meeting. They have been welcomed with open arms by the older kids, and their voices are part of what's heard as well. So that's been really, really something important that I've been really proud of. And we've also done a lot in terms of increasing student choice. So our students get a lot of choice throughout their day. They get to choose their foreign language. They get to choose the arts elective that they can take. And they get to take a course that's sort of a genius hour kind of type of class. They also get to select that as well. And so I like the idea that there's so much choice that's part of our students' experience. And they also get to decide whether they want to be part of an advanced math and science track. It is not done through testing. It is a personal decision that the students make. This was really based on a lot of conversations that I've had with sort of the same people that I worked with Lucy on, in terms of how you create opportunity. My hope is, the thing that I love the most is in our sixth grade, we have two sections of this track, and I'm hoping that one day we'll have all of our sections will all be the advanced math track.
There's so much good stuff there, but you know, I even just the simplest thing, and it's like, you know, you get in these traditions, you get so used to stuff, right? And it makes sense to honor kids for what they're doing right and aligning that to values, but I love that they also turn around and connect that to their teachers that they see every single day and what it is about them that they're living out, right? On a day-to-day basis. The empowerment.
Oh my God. I have to tell you what happened at the last.
Yeah, tell us.
The last one was the best one. So we have a teacher that we had got a federal grant for a teacher to come from China to teach Mandarin to our students. And she came here. She didn't know anyone. She'd never been to the United States. She learned English in China. She'd never really been to an English-speaking country before. And now she's teaching American kids. And I went to China last year. And let me just tell you, my school, which is located in a very urban, it's in Jersey City, city. It's very urban. It's the most diverse city in New Jersey, which makes it one of the most diverse cities in the United States. Coming from China, that's really different. And the award, the value that we recognized last week was courage. And the students decided they wanted to give her that award. And this girl said, oh my God, she said, you know, when I think about the courage that she has shown, it inspired me to think that I could do those same things in my own life. Wow.
Did she talk about, too, like what those things might be that she wanted to do?
Yeah, she said the idea of leaving your home, taking a risk to learn and to grow.
It's beautiful.
Which is ideally what we want our students to do. Yeah, it was beautiful. It's just amazing. Just amazing.
Take those type of risks and the kid, you know, they can articulate what that is. Not sure that we can measure it on a standardized test, and that's okay. Because listen, this is like what it's all about, you know, and to have that kid experience that moment, to see it lived out through the teacher, like, wow, that's such an inspirational tale.
Yeah, it really was.
So how did you even get involved in education? What inspired you to pursue that career?
So that's an interesting story, but I know what happened. So I knew that I wanted to be involved in some sort of social justice project. And I knew that from when I was in high school. I had this real lefty teacher who was just a really strong presence. He was a very dynamic teacher. And he taught a lot about sort of very traditional social protest movements throughout American history, you know, the history of organized labor, the history of women's suffrage. He did not do, because this is something that, you know, we see, he was a little weak in terms of when it came to Black history, but, you know, we did learn it. So that's something that I did make note of. But learning that really inspired me to think about how I wanted to make a difference in the world, and that I wanted whatever contribution I made to really change things for the better, you know. And so that was something that I really wanted to do. And I wasn't exactly sure how. And then I decided to continue my studies of history at college. But I knew that I was always thinking about that. When I was a senior in college, I started to look for opportunities after college to do social service work. And I started applying to a bunch of things. And I even had a telephone interview by this nice woman who ran this program called the Coro Fellows in Chicago. And I don't know whether you know who this is. She had this funny name when I spoke to her on the phone. She was very nice, but she was a tough interviewer. The lady's name was Michelle Obama, and I did not get that job. But that is okay.
Oh, my gosh.
But anyway, that is okay, because I wound up instead going to Israel and working in a social service program there, which was really powerful. And I had a lot of opportunities. I worked with my Hebrew's good, so I was able to work with, I was able to do a lot of different things. I got to work on in a dairy farm and work with cows. But more importantly, I got to work with developmentally disabled young people. And I worked with new immigrants from Ethiopia and the former Soviet Union who were about to take their matriculation exams. And that was really powerful as well. So I got to have a lot of opportunity to work with young people. And I found that really exciting. And when I came back to the States after that, I was thinking about going to grad school in history. But I had a crazy boss who said, you know, you really should teach. That's what you want to do. And I was working a lot with young kids and like sort of religious schools and youth. I was a youth advisor. And I really liked all that work. And so it kind of made sense for me to go into education. And I had some friends that were involved with that too. And I knew I wanted to go to a progressive school for education. I went to Bank Street, which is a very, very progressive education school in New York City, founded around the ideas of putting social studies at the core, having students study their communities, yeah. Like young, you know, the kindergarten and the pre-kindergartner should learn about the school itself. And then they learn about the world around them. Hmm. And, you know, sort of there's a big emphasis on mapping. That was a big thing, and field experience. And it's kind of like I've came full circle, because the school that I work at now, Learning Community, is so based around those ideas. Like the students every year in September, the pre-K visits my office and they visit the custodian and they visit the cafeteria. And that's part of what we do. Our first grade runs a post office and they send the students to the mail carriers. Everyone writes letters to each other.
Really?
And oh my God, it's the best thing ever. It's a lot of work. I wish it could happen every day of the year because it makes everybody feel great, you know, and you have all these kids stamping letters and it's a really nice post office. It's much nicer than if you go to the real post office.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, the service is much better there. Our kindergarten runs they study bread and they run a bakery and all of the bread, the bakery operates for a week or so. And during that time, all the food goes to hunger organizations within our community. And that's just really part of sort of who we are. And now, and then this year I implemented a global studies course that we launched that's really going well. And it has a lot to do with the idea of how do you take the things that you learned in these younger grades and the values that we teach in our school, and how do you take that when you leave our school in eighth grade and go out into the world and make a difference in the world? So we're really proud of that. In fact, I was just in that class last week, and the teacher did this incredible work with the students where he had assigned them. This sounds like a simple assignment, but it was incredible. It was called Tea for Two. And the kids had to spend about an hour with another kid that they did not know. They had to go out of the school building, spend time with each other, get to know each other. They had to take a picture, and then they wrote journals and then presented on it. This was really incredible. Yeah. And you think about what's going on nationally in terms of these issues of dialogue, and we hear a lot about people living in bubbles and all this kind of thing. And so work like this, it's really helpful. It really is. And the kids really found it to be powerful. It was something else. It made me think a lot about what we were doing, and I was very proud. And I also think it might be something that we should explore also with our faculty, because I think sometimes not everybody in a school really knows each other that well too. You know, people kind of hang with their tribes.
Absolutely. So that was in an eighth grade class?
Yeah. Yeah. That's our eighth grade global studies course.
How would you transfer that activity to the staff? What would that look like?
Well, I was thinking about kind of doing something similar, but I think it's trickier with adults. We have a lot more guards up sometimes. And, you know, people read in a lot more into it. Our kids are a lot more willing to take those risks sometimes. So, you know, I think I'm going to have to talk to some more people. I ran it past a group of faculty members, and I kind of got a lukewarm response. Mm. So I have to kind of talk to a few more people, because I was actually thinking they could do almost the same type of thing. Send them out into the community, go find a place to hang out, grab a cup of coffee, take a picture, get to know each other a little bit, and then come back and share with everybody else. You know, sometimes these things happen organically in our building, but, you know, that's always, and I think in every school building, but it's not always the way that works.
Sure.
You want to kind of foster those networks as much as possible. And I know that's something that people really long for. In our school used to be a very small school. Now it's a larger school. And I think people long for the days of when it was small because everybody knew each other. If you think about that in a school, that matters a lot. For people to be successful in their work, to know that everybody's kind of got your back and you trust everybody. Mm-hmm. That means something to people.
Yeah, trust, relationship, connection. You mentioned tribe. So it's like fostering all that for your community. Much easier to do at a smaller scale. And as you grow, definitely a challenge for sure.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to my former teaching partner, and she was saying that when I had left my former school to come to my current school, it was a really amazing environment and it was really tight. But I think a lot of it had to do with we had worked with a school leader. There had been a lot of transition in the school leadership, which I think is partially why the school, I think the environment changed over time, just because when you have that much turnover in leadership, it's hard. And, but we had had a leader when we came into the building that was very much about empowering people to try things out and just trying to be just fully supportive of whatever anybody wanted to do. Let's do it. Let's try it. Go ahead. Do it. I trust you. I believe in you. Do it. And because we received a lot of that sort of, you know, willingness to do these things, we were able to push a lot of initiatives through. And sometimes we would start things that were small and they would grow, and we would try to bring more and more people on board. And I think that it created a lot of a real spirit of camaraderie in the building. But when they, you know, and it's a lesson for schools, when the leadership changed and there was so much, there's been just a lot of leadership change at that school, it makes it harder sometimes to really kind of sustain that. Because there's a lot of other stuff going on. So, but that really was, you know, when you had this environment where everybody knew each other and everybody believed in each other and everybody trusted each other, we were able to do a lot of really great things.
So does that impact at all your leadership style now?
Well, it's this guy, one of my many mentors over the years said, you know, You're not one of the herd anymore, and you're not one of the gang anymore when you become the principal. And so that's one of the challenging things sometimes I think about school leadership is that you at one point really want to embody what I had just described to you. But at the same time, a lot of people will, you know, people have interesting relationships with leadership in their life. They've had positive experiences with leadership. They've had negative experiences with leadership. So anything that you do, you know, and of course, all school leaders make mistakes. So when you have a misstep and somebody's already having a complex relationship with leadership, it becomes much harder sometimes to really kind of get everybody to bounce back and kind of say, well, that was a mistake, but it wasn't really, you know, a reflection of who that individual is. But sometimes people see it that way. So I think it's one of the more challenging aspects of being a school leader is that I always feel like, you know, I always have to remind myself that I hold this invisible megaphone in my hand. Yep. So if I say something,
right,
I have to remember that it sounds like I am blaring, like, you know, across a stadium in terms of what I'm saying. That's been one of the toughest lessons I've had as a school leader, is just realizing that is part of what comes along with it. And so you can believe, or I believed, oh, well, I would be like that school leader that I worked with before. Try it, do it, I trust you. But I don't always think that's, although that is the spirit behind what I do, I also have to respect and understand that that is not always how people experience that, due to a lot of factors. Maybe the way I launched it, maybe the way I said it, maybe something else that's going on with them. All these things can make it, it's not as simple as you imagine it to be. That's just kind of part of the fascinating aspect of being a school leader.
Yeah, that invisible megaphone is a really nice metaphor. And I don't know who told me this, if I was at a conference or somebody said it on the podcast, but they said, you know, the principal sneezes and the school catches a cold.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's that type of thing. You don't realize the influence you have, even when you want to take a gentle approach, you know, but it still may seem, like you said, that you have an invisible megaphone. You're saying it sternly or loudly. That's such a learning curve for school leaders. I'm curious, you know, you talked about too, you transitioned right into school leadership, you're a principal, and then you find yourself on the outside looking in, I guess, in some respects of the school community. You know, I mentioned in the bio that you're a part of the mastermind. Has that helped at all, or in what ways has it helped you, I guess, in your school leadership?
Oh, it's been immensely helpful. I think the opportunity to hear from other people that my experiences are not the only ones that are like this, that everyone is experiencing many of the same things. The stories that I hear remind me very much of, you know, the experiences that I've had. And I think that, you know, doing these things have really made a difference in terms of helping you through the challenges of what school leadership is today. And so the mastermind has been incredible, and it's something that I really look forward to every week in terms of hearing those stories and having the chance to connect and to hear other people's perspective on an issue that I might be dealing with, or I can offer perspective to other people. And I've also, I do kind of live things as well. I started an organization of, we were actually all, there are a bunch of small charter schools in the Jersey City and Hoboken area that we were all suing the state, actually. but I kind of thought that we could do more than just sue the state. Maybe we could all get together and work on stuff for kids.
Why not?
I know, crazy idea. So I suggested that we all get together and work on projects together. And it's been amazing because we're a really dynamic group of people. And we have very different strengths, and there are very different kinds of principals, and there are very different kinds of schools. And that's just what makes it really terrific. And every year now, we've been planning this. The first day back, we run a teacher sort of ed camp, and we have a keynote speaker. We had Dan Tricario spoke this year. And the year before we had, that was a big deal for me. We had Alfie Cohn, who I've loved his work. So that was very exciting. So we had Alfie Cohn the year before. I got to, I made sure I cleaned my car and drove him to the airport. It was a big deal. So
nice. Yeah.
We did it. So it was a great experience, and we're looking and we're beginning to plan for, the coming year. I think I have an idea of who we want to bring in to speak for that. So it's really, really great. And so we wanted to create opportunities for the network that we formed for the teachers to form that as well. Yeah. So we have one of the teachers, she's hyper organized, and she said it's just like when she did the guest seating at her wedding. And so she always designs where everybody sits so that you have, you know, everybody teaching music sitting together for the opportunity to develop these networks and, you know, an opportunity to talk and to share. And this year we created a whole sharing piece and really proud of that, to be honest. And so, but I've done that. And one of those principals I work with pretty closely. And that's just been really amazing. Just any time to spend time and talk with other principals is just, it's invaluable. It really is.
Absolutely. It just, you know, I found it to be a very lonely position. And I don't know about you, but I don't do that well on my own, as operating as a lone wolf, so to speak. You know, I'm just worse off for it. Like, I'm gonna make poor decisions, and if it's not for the solidarity and the shared experience, you know, that this is normal and here's how you can get through it, or here's how to best serve the community, just you know, for the connecting, right, and building those relationships and trying to offer something valuable to other human beings in a similar line of work, you know, you grow so much, you become friends, and you know, that's what it's all about. It's good to hear that you're involved in a number of different organizations and opportunities like that. Today's show is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending has a hassle-free, year-round fundraising program for schools. And believe it or not, their CEO and founder, Matt Miller, was a guest on episode 5 of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. He can increase your school spirit with custom stickers for your school and raise funds at the same time. There's no upfront costs, no volunteers, no selling. It's absolutely free to you, the school. If you're sick of the same old ways of raising money, check out School Spirit Vending at schoolspiritvending.com. Colin, I'm curious, you know, we're talking about warm and fuzzy stuff. Let's talk about something tough. What has been your worst leadership mistake, and what have you learned from it?
I would have to say mine has been that there have been times where I have been really quick to misread a situation, especially in sort of my early days of the principalship. I would imagine that situations were different than what they were, perhaps, you know, because going on exactly what you said before, the little bit of the isolation of the position, and I would be too quick to take action. And then, you know, then there would be a real, you know, kind of a response back from the community. Like, I cannot believe that he made that decision, or he spoke to me that way. And that's really hard, because those people felt a lot of pain from that experience. And I have tried since then to undo that pain. And it's hard, because people come to that from very different places. And I don't know whether, you know, I can fix it so much. And, you know, I'm very sorry about that. So I do think about that a lot. So I think that was my biggest mistake.
And now, I guess, through experience and stuff, you've learned to, I guess, how to pause or really think through those situations before being quick to respond. And outside of that, and changing the way you do respond, is it possible to repair those relationships at all? Or what do you do then after a relationship's been damaged?
That's a really interesting question. You know, everybody's different in terms of this, and I'm very tough on myself, as many principals are, I think. So I find that, you know, I always focus on the most difficult relationship, the one that's probably the most damaged and probably the one that'll be the hardest to fix. You know, some people I've apologized multiple times to. Some people, I'm not sure whether an apology really is what's needed. I'm not quite sure what is needed. So that's tough. You know, you do have to continue on with the work, though. And the other thing that I think, one thing that I've definitely learned through the mastermind is sometimes it's not always you. Sometimes it can be somebody else. And that's not to put that I didn't have a role to play and perhaps a relationship turning sour. But I also have to remember that sometimes people, you know, if they've had a painful experience and they're really having trouble moving past it, then sometimes that is the way it might be for them. And, you know, and I have to understand that, I have to respect that, and I have to be patient and hope that, you know, at a certain point, perhaps they will get over the negative experience that they had and that we can move forward.
It's good. You know, it stinks. You try to repair relationships where possible, but sometimes it isn't you, or it's partly you, partly something else. And, you know, you just do what you can. You can't control that other person. So,
yeah, my sister is funny because in Mastermind, we read a lot of stuff from the corporate world. So my sister is a corporate lawyer. So okay. She'll always share things for me from like what she's learning, what they're doing at the big business. And so she suggested that I do this suggestion box because her company was going through a major turnover and they were being bought by this other huge company. And it's a big deal. So the CEO would do this suggestion box, this question box, and he would read from the question box every day to the employees, and he would read any question and give them an answer to create this level of transparency. So she said, you know, you should do that after my first year. She's like, if people are upset with your leadership, you should do this box, and that's a good way to do it. So the box was put out in the faculty room, and the suggestions came in. And like some of the questions were like, when is the therapy dog coming back into the school? But some of the questions were, you know, an anonymous forum for questions. Some of them were tough. Like some of them were nasty. Some of them were kind of hurtful. And, but I was like, well, you know, you set up this process, you have to do your duty and fill and go through it. So I would spend like every weekend, I would write my answer. I would try to be really thoughtful in my response. And then I would share these questions with everybody. And at that time I had been assigned a coach, but the school board was really wanted me to have this coach. And he's an amazing man who is a former school superintendent. And he came and he said, listen, the first thing you're going to stop doing is that suggestion box. He's like, cause I'm going to tell you what's happening with that suggestion box. He's like, you might be putting that out there. He's like, but I can tell you that, you know, first of all, it's getting inside you and it's bothering you and you can't have that. That's not how you're going to run a school. And that was a really good point for someone to stop me and say that because it definitely felt that way. What I also found out later on is that many, many other people in the building found reading those questions very upsetting. And they almost felt like it was tearing the school community apart a little bit by reading these questions. I think other people maybe felt differently. Maybe they were glad that that was out in the open and their questions were, you know, putting me on the spot and getting that answer out of me. But I don't know whether even for them, that's the satisfaction they want because they might have wanted something else. So I'm really glad. That was something that I really learned from. I would not suggest that for most people. I'm not sure whether that's the best forum.
Hey, you brought up the therapy dog. How do you guys utilize the therapy dog at your school?
Oh, yeah. We're very proud of this. We have I had worked with some therapy dogs in my former district. And we have a dog. It's actually my dog. And he's a therapy dog. And that was the only way I could figure out how to get a dog because I was determined to have one. But at home, the whole thing was, oh, well, who will be home with the dog? And then I went to ASCD and I sat next to this principal from Oregon. And I do not know who this guy is. And if he's listening, I want to say thank you. And he said, hey, you know what? I got my dog certified as a therapy dog. It's the most popular thing at school. And he's showing pictures of the dog wearing a Superman shirt and, you know, at the school carnival, wearing sunglasses. It was awesome. So anyway, I was determined that we were going to do this, but the bar was set so high because the dog had to be hypoallergenic. The dog had to be great with children and had to be a rescue dog. And but we found one and he's amazing and took him to the classes, got him certified. And he works with our reading specialist. And so the students read to him on a regular basis.
I love it.
He's also works with students that are a lot of us. We have some students that have experienced some real trauma in their lives. So that's very important. With our borderline autistic students, that's something else that he does. I taught an eighth grade discussion course last year, and he came and taught that class with me. There's a section of our school library that has, his name is Ricky, so they're Ricky books that are books about dogs. And so we have, you know, and he has some regulars, and we got him in the yearbook this year. That was awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so he's at school a lot. I will say he has some contractual issues because one time I had him there at the spell. I had one of those, you know, as principal, you have some late nights, obviously. So it was the spelling bee last year, and I forgot that I had needed to have the walker and be there. So I had him at school, And I learned that if you, his contract clearly says, states that he works no longer than 4 o'clock. He's not going to do it. He when I came back to my office, he left a surprise for me.
How about that?
Yeah. So that I'm aware of it now.
A little peaceful protest there.
He clocks out at 4.
Hey, I'm curious. So do you buy the dog already trained to be a therapy dog, or
no?
So that's something you had to go through.
You have to train. No one can get that. You have to work with the dog. So that's in any case, you actually have to get the dog. You have to train the dog yourself. And fortunately, he's an amazing dog who loves people, and you know, and he's a very loving dog. So it's not a problem at all.
For principals that are interested in it, I guess, how long is the training? Like, what kind of time commitment?
About like 6 months. Depends on your dog. I am like a small fish in this because I read that there was another principal in New Jersey whose dog was in the Westminster Kennel Club show last week and is also a therapy dog at that school. So our dog, although he is a wonderful dog and he's a, you know, he was not in any dog shows.
But he's in the yearbook, so it's okay.
But he made it in the yearbook. But you can do it. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a principal doing it, but it is a really amazing thing. I really think it is one of the more important things. It really creates, I will also say this, this is a little small, interesting side bonus, is that I like to have him around when I interview people because I can tell right away by the response on a candidate when they see that we have a dog. It is a major, it says to people a lot about who we are as a school and where we stand on our students where we stand on innovation. And it also says a lot to me about certain people that really get it very quickly. And I have had some of our best people that we've brought on have said that was one of the things that they really thought was that they had to work at our school was because of that.
Yeah, that's wow. Does he ask any questions?
Well, sometimes there are certain people that he really likes. Like he has, that's kind of funny is once in a while, it's just, there are certain people he just decides he loves and he jumps in their lap. So sometimes there have been certain people we've been interviewing.
During the interview?
In an interview, and all of a sudden he's on their lap. But the thing is because he's so amazing, it actually, at first they're a little startled, and then it's actually very relaxing for them. They actually kind of loosen up because he's sitting on their lap.
I would thrive in that environment and having a dog on my lap during the interview.
Yeah.
Love it.
It actually, the conversation is so much better when the dog's on your lap. It really is.
So, Colin, when you think of the word leader, who's the first person that comes to mind?
Well, I thought about two people. I thought a lot about Martin Luther King, and I also thought about President Obama, because both of them, I think, had the view that really matters in leadership is that we do not lead necessarily for the moment of our leadership. It is about we are leading for the long term and for long term change, and that we have to really realize that our leadership lasts far beyond what we do, that we are here to build and sustain and grow, but it's not about us. It's about the people that we're serving, and that we must always try to do our very best through our words, our actions, and how we inspire others for people to move forward. So that's really what I think about when I think a lot about leadership and, you know, why it matters.
Concerning school leadership, have you changed your mind on any ideas in the past few years?
In terms of school leadership? Yes, I think so. I think that I have really had to realize that timing is very strange in terms of the whole experience of being a school leader. I find that there are certain things when you want to do something and you want to bring about a change, by making a sort of a blanket statement about from now on, we're going to be doing it this way, is actually a way to throw your work back almost a year, but to slowly but surely begin to form small groups of people to talk about an issue that you want to move forward and you want to promote, and getting people that are, and then allowing those people to be part of a group that can study the idea and then sort of bring that back to the faculty. That is how you move it forward. So I really have changed my mind on sort of, instead of going and looking at things that are not like, you know, when I began my work, I would look at things and think, oh, well, we're not doing this and we're not doing that. And this has to be fixed right away. It must be. No, it actually, you need to take a breath. You need to take time to develop a process to address this issue and watch it evolve over time. Making these quick decisions to fix something right away aside from like, you know, facility issues, then you do have to make a quick decision sometimes. But yeah, you know, when you're not dealing with your physical plant, and, you know, I think that when you're dealing with human beings, I think you really do need to look at it for the sort of where it is long term rather than short term.
So wrapping up, we just have a couple of quick questions and then a deep one at the end. What's one book every principal should read right now and why?
Okay, I have two. He's probably going to be our speaker next year. I am a huge fan of the amazing Dr. Richard Milner. He's written two books that I adore. One is called Start Where You Are, But Don't Stay There. And the other one is called Racing to Class. And these are amazing books about the influence that race has on the education system in a very deep and powerful way. He talks about not an achievement gap, but an opportunity gap. The idea that we have to think about sort of the real division that occurs due to race in education and what that means, and how teachers perceive and understand race is going to directly affect how their students, particularly their, you know, Latino, Black students, how they're going to achieve. And it's very powerful work. It's tough. They're not hard books to read, but I think some of the stuff is tough because he really cuts to the core about that big issue about how schools and school systems and individual teachers and school leaders address race. This is really the core of how we are going to, are we really 100% behind full achievement for our society?
Yeah, tough questions to ponder. For sure, but valuable reading. What do you do for fun, Colin?
I love to spend time with, I love to spend time with my family. I have two boys that keep me very, very busy. My husband is a rabbi, and he's a lot of fun. And so we all have a good time together. And I also love to bake and cook. That's something I really enjoy. And I also attempt as much as I can to be a runner.
Yeah, me too.
It's aspirational at all times.
There's nothing wrong with aspirational goals. Nothing wrong at all. Hey, if you could automatically be good at something, what would it be?
I would have to say I would like to be really good at speaking French.
Why is that?
Because I just would like to be able to do that.
Just because.
I would like to speak French, and maybe I'd like to also be able to do Mandarin too.
Sounds good. What message would you put on all school marquees if you could do that for a day across our nation?
Because you came here today, you made a difference.
I love that. Because you came here today, you made a difference. Well, Colin, I'm proud of you. You made it to the end of the show. Here's the last question. You're building a school from the ground up. You're not limited by budget or resources. Your only limitation is your imagination. How would you build your dream school, and what would your top three priorities be?
Well, I would want my school to, first of all, be located in a place where it needs to be. So the school has to be in an area that needs a great school. So that's probably going to be in an urban area that has experienced a tremendous amount of neglect over time due to sort of racism, economic disparity, that kind of thing. Number two is that the school needs to have, as many people have said, it needs to have the funding to really bring on the best people, and they need to be paid the salary that they deserve for the work that they do. I also think that the other thing that it needs is that it almost needs to have, like, the staff needs to be quite enormous, because if you want it to be a community-based school, you want sort of, you know, medical care for the families, English as a second language classes. You also want the ability for the teachers to have significant times off, because I find more and more that the teaching profession, I was just spending some time with some friends over the weekend that work in education, and one person said, you know, I would say never to marry a teacher because the occupation is hopeless. Now, I found that very depressing, yeah, but I also know, I mean, sorry to bring everybody down, but I also think that we need to really think about how we could create some more innovative ways for people, and especially teachers, to be able to take care of themselves more and to experience less stress so they can do the really important work, and for people to feel like this is a lifelong thing that they can do. You know, I wonder whether, you know, we need people in it for the long haul, but it becomes harder and harder every year. So I think that's something that needs to be addressed. So I'd want more people in the school so that like people maybe work like 5 months, then take 2 months off, where they would be going to other countries and working with other schools, learning about other school systems, and then developing international partnerships they'd bring back to their current school.
Love it. Colin, thank you so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Do you have any parting words of advice, and what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Okay, so I am on Twitter at Mr. Colin Hogan, and you can also email me if you like at chogan@lccsnj.org. I'd love to talk to anybody about anything. And my final words are is that, you know what, we face really difficult challenges in our work, but it is worth doing. And I know that sometimes we can get caught up in sort of the small minutia of things, but the most important thing is that what we do matters, and that we are at the wonderful opportunity to spend our day with children. And that makes it all worthwhile at the end of the day.
Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and Colin. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type Colin in the search bar. The show notes page will pop up where you'll get highlights of the episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. Colin, thank you so much for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better. Better Leaders, thank you for joining us on the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Visit us at betterleadersbetterschools.com, a blog and podcast made specifically for you to help you meet your leadership potential. Have you gotten value from today's show? Help me reach even more listeners by leaving a 5-star rating and review. Click the podcast artwork and press the Show Some Love link to leave an honest rating and review. A long, long time ago in a galaxy far away, patrons would sponsor artists to create something the patron valued. Would you consider becoming a patron of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast? If you found this podcast valuable, if the show has pushed your thinking about leadership, and if you've benefited in any way, then I would be honored if you would become a sponsor. Sponsorship is easy. Head over to patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes to become a patron for as little as $1 a month. If you pledge $10 a month, I'll send you one of my favorite leadership books every other month. That's patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes. Do you have a question or need some leadership advice? I want to connect with you. I read every email, tweet, snap that's sent to me. Links are in the show notes to connect via email and social media. Better Leaders, Better Schools is a proud member of the Edu Podcast Network, podcast for educators, podcast by educators. You can listen to more great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.